We're going to Masada tonight. Masada is a very interesting place. It doesn't relate specifically to anything biblically, although there are things that occurred there that happened during New Testament times. And it does illustrate the nature of the rebellion amongst the Jews in the most fervent factions against the Roman government. And you've probably heard a lot about Masada. So I'll take you there tonight. Here's where it is. Here's the Sea of Galilee. Here's, oh man. Yeah, okay, there it is. I can't read it from that angle. There's Jerusalem. It's from here to the Sea of Galilee, we've got 65 miles. Nothing in Israel is really, 65 miles. We'd go past that on our way to Phoenix, so that's no big deal. And it's not very many miles from Jerusalem. And, of course, in the first century, they would have been walking, so you... What you have from the Dead Sea to Jerusalem is about a 2.5 or 3 day trip, is what they told us, walking, and none of us got out and tried to walk it, so we'll take their word for it. Here's a close up. We're going to this area in just a minute. Masada is just a little further south than that on the Dead Sea. It's a very interesting place. It's the place that was built during the 37 years of Herod the Great's reign in Jerusalem. Actually, Masada existed before Herod the Great came on the scene, but he's the one who really developed it. And I couldn't get it all on this scan. I'll show you these places when we take a look at the pictures. Over here on this end, we have the famous palaces that are on the terraces. There's three of them there. And then there's another palace here, another one here, another one here, another one here that Herod built and designed. And then we actually have a swimming pool back in this area. It was occupied by Herod, and then it was occupied by zealot Jews, and then it was occupied by the Romans again, and then it was occupied by Christians during the Byzantine era. And to get to it, until a few years ago, Bob, I think when you went there, the only way up there was the Snake Path. Now, that's one of those names that tries to discourage people from taking it, I think. I remember in Colorado, outside of Fort Collins, there's a place called Rattlesnake Dam, and they couldn't figure out why nobody ever wanted to go up there. Well, you change the name, you might get a few people up there. The Snake Path is so named because of how it winds around going up that hill. You start out at 1,400 feet below sea level. It's the lowest place on Earth. That's where the Dead Sea is. And you get up to, on certain parts of this complex, to 33 feet above sea level. So it's a very dramatic rise right out of the valley. And I'm standing at the bottom looking up at the lift that takes you there. And this is a view from some distance away of the three palaces. The lift is on this side over here. And this is another view of it. Here's the three palaces and then all of this area. This area here on this end is the area that's up in the air 33 feet above sea level. This is a Roman siege ramp. We'll talk more about that in just a second. Here's another angle looking at Masada. Here's a little diagram that helps you to see what all of those areas are involved with. Masada was really... I was trying to think of a comparison to the way that politicians and leaders use a place of safety today. And Masada would actually be like Air Force One. When 9/11 occurred, of course, we all know that George Bush got aboard Air Force One, and before they could figure out what was going on, he was flying at 45,000 feet, random patterns over the United States. It was a place where he could be safe from any possible attack. Well, that's what Masada was for Herod. And there were on more than one occasion opportunities for him to go there and to use that place as a safe haven as he tried to figure out what was happening in Israel, whether the Romans were coming to get him or whether some of his own people were coming to get him. You know, in the Roman Empire, the way that they exchanged power was by murdering each other. Assassinations was the way that they ascended to the throne. So all of these guys were extremely paranoid. And they built for themselves these fortifications, safe places for their family and their closest advisors and for themselves. And at the top of Masada, they built walls. Now, you're talking about nearly 1,400 feet or 1,400 feet out of the floor and then a wall around a place on a plateau. This is a picture I took looking down at that Roman ramp. It used to, that's 300, at its highest, is 395 feet from the valley floor to the top of the ramp. But excavations carried out by geologists in the 90s determined that there's actually a natural ridge that runs along through there, and that the Romans needed to come up with about 30 yards of fill rather than 30 feet, I guess it is, of fill to build that ramp eventually. These are examples of stones that the Zealots used to roll down on the Romans as they sieged Masada in about 72 AD. And this is an example of a Roman catapult that would have been used against those that were at Masada. This was built for a TV movie and was left there. So it of course is not 2,000 years old, but simply as an example. You take a lift up there that goes 900 meters in distance. That's about 2,400 feet, half a mile maybe. From this point, see that little box right up there? I'm not a guy who likes heights, so I kind of white-knuckled it on this thing, you know, a little cable car all the way up there. But it was a beautiful view, and looking back, you can see part of an old Roman garrison that was used when they besieged the city. I'll talk some more about that. In fact, when you get to the top, you see this outcrop. That is part of where, in 72 AD, the Romans besieged Masada and tried to wait them out. They were hoping that their supplies would run out. And while they were there waiting, they built this wall, and you can't see that this wall continues all the way around that plateau, so that there was no possible way of escape for the rebels that were on the top of Masada. Herod built some very fancy stuff up there. It was a place of luxury, and when you go into some of these structures, it's just absolutely amazing the level of engineering that existed. And I took this picture as we went through what was known as the bathhouse. It was the place where they had their hot tub, where Herod had his hot tub, and it is quite luxurious. The width of the wall is just astounding to me. It was like 5-6 feet thick, so that whatever energy was produced on the inside there in the way of heat remained inside there. And this was literally a steam bath. They've done some reconstruction based upon the ruins that are there. This is obviously, as you look at it, would be some modern ceramics, but they built it to the specifications of the old stuff. And what these are vent pipes for the hot air that they were able to generate underneath by putting the floor on a platform. And this is about 3 feet off the ground. And they had hot air flowing through this area, very hot air. And then they built the bath the water works on top of it. So you can imagine all of the hot air running underneath here and coming out in the vents and heating the water that was in there. It was quite a luxurious hot tub. And I don't know how many people could have fit in there, maybe a couple of dozen, so it was very large. This is the structure of the roof that they believe survived some of the attacks and probably is intact from 2,000 years ago. The walls and the floors inside were typical of the ordination that you'd find in a Roman palace. Very, very fine tile work here, and they had, I wanted you to see this, they had a way to drain their floors. Somehow or another, the drain that was there originally has been misplaced, but these things were often on platforms so that water would be drained away in inclement weather or for whatever other purposes, and then all of that water would be gathered into cisterns because they were in a dry area. Here's another place where there you can see the ancient tile, and they say these tiles come from sometime B.C., and you can see the imprint of tiles that were removed for some purpose in the past. All along through these ruins, you'll see a black line that runs, if you notice, and what that indicates is what is genuine is found below what is original. What has been reconstructed is found above that line. So when they found these ruins, all of this stuff below it was actually the way that they found it. Now they've cleaned this up, and what this represents is how they dealt with the walls. Kind of like our drywall, they would put stucco on that rough wall, and then they painted it. And that's actually the paint that comes from 2,000 years ago. And it's so interesting to me because as I look at that, it looks so modern, doesn't it? Those are the colors that people put in their houses today. That's that we've rediscovered these colors. And then these color schemes. You know, let me suggest to our painter friends that if you really want to get ahead of the curve, go back 2,000 years. And here are the colors that need to be used. And then the designs on the walls to make it look like there's paneling. Very fascinating stuff. And then outside in the stoneworks on the walls, they made these walls to look like paneling too. So this is a picture of one of the commander's residences. And then we've got this picture, which is a picture of something that came later, after the first century, one of the Byzantine churches that existed in that area. The ruins are like so many ruins in Israel. It takes a lot of imagination to figure out what it was that was there, but they recognize that this had to be the commander's residence because of its size and its strategic location, and what all of these little cubby holes were in that particular palace area. One wonders whether these were used to store items, whether that was maybe that was their chest of drawers. That was the bureau or something. Who knows what that was. These guard towers that are found in certain locations there are fascinating, and much of it has been reconstructed. But here's what the ruins look like when the archaeologists arrive on the scene. By the way, Masada was destroyed more than once, and so they would find a lot of these areas with ruins disheveled. But I wanted to take you to this wall. This is the wall where they believe it all came down, where it all ended. I learned when I went to Israel that Josephus among the Jews is not well respected as a historian. And I learned something that I'd never known before. And since returning home, I've done a little investigation, and I wonder why I had never stumbled across this truth before. But here's the truth. The only record we have of what actually happened at Masada comes to us from Josephus. Josephus was a Jewish historian who lived in the latter part of the first century and into the second century. And you probably have Flavius Josephus, a one volume, the history of the wars of the Jews, and some of his other writings, which record what happened among the Jews in Palestine in the first century and the second century. And the reason why I say he's not held in high regard among Jews is because he sold out to the Roman government to save his skin. When the Romans began to persecute Jews, he played both sides against the middle and attached himself to the Roman side while professing to be for the Jewish side. And he actually wrote his work, The Wars of the Jews, as a favor to the Romans to try to get Jews to suppress their rebellion against the Roman government. So anything that he writes, the Jews look upon with great suspicion as to its accuracy and its details. I said all of that to tell you that he is the only one that we know of that can give us any insights into what happened at Masada. So there may be some exaggerations to his story, and in fact, Israelites believe that there certainly was. But this has been identified right here as the place where the end came. In 72 A.D., after the destruction of Jerusalem, when the Zealots in Jerusalem were battling with the Roman Empire, they came to Masada and they overran the Roman defenses at the bottom of the valley. And they very quickly then took control of Masada. And they entrenched themselves there. Masada is engineered in its water supplies in such a way that if it rains, they can sustain themselves. And these zealots brought with them plenty of foods and stores. And before the Romans could besiege Masada, they laid up in store enough food to take care of them for an extended period of time. It is said by Josephus that there were 960 souls on this place when the Romans decided to besiege it. They built the wall that I showed you around the entire area, and then they built that siege ramp, 300 and some feet in the air, after 2 years of besieging the city before they overran it. When they got there, they expected some resistance, and they found none. What they found were 960 bodies, reportedly. Archaeologists have discovered these little pieces of clay pottery with individuals' names on them, and they happened to find 12 of these with 12 names. Jews regularly organized their synagogues and other places with 12 leaders, and they believe these are the 12 names of the 12 leaders of those who were responsible for the 960 in Masada. Because Judaism takes a very dim view on suicide, it was decided among the 12 leaders that they would murder each other. Now, that to me is a difficult contradiction to overcome. You know, we can't commit suicide because that's wrong, but we'll murder each other so that we're not guilty of suicide. But that, according to Josephus, is what they did. The 12 leaders took like in our zone program, be wary of zone leaders, decided, okay, on my list I've got these people, I will kill them, and then you will kill me. So at the end, only one person had to commit suicide. That's the way the story goes. The reason we know this is two women were able to, with five children, hide in one of the cisterns amongst the dead bodies and played dead, and they supposedly got out and told the whole story about what happened on Masada. One wonders whether or not all of those facts are true. But they did find artifacts indicating that the people there were well supplied. They found these sandals, which were still perfectly preserved, being in such, it's a climate very much like Arizona, so it's very, very dry. They also found stores, plenty of food. The residents of Masada before the Roman Empire got there destroyed and burned every building that was there except their food supplies. And the purpose was to demonstrate to the Romans and to the rest of the world that they could have stayed there as long as they wanted to. They had plenty of food. They weren't hurting for that, but they chose rather than be taken captive by the Romans to commit mass suicide. This is a view looking down toward one of the palaces that was on one of the precipices, and this is actually a picture that shows some of the ornaments that surrounded that particular palace. The Jewish influence there today is easily seen. This is a synagogue that they told us is the oldest synagogue to be found, or one of the oldest, but I think they actually said, I don't remember less, maybe you can correct me, whether this is the oldest or one of the oldest synagogues in existence in Israel. So this gives you an idea of how they were built and constructed. And they're very simple, but they're functional. And it faces Jerusalem. And here, those zealot Jews then worshipped according to the tradition of their elders. And there are, in more than one location, to be found mikvahs, ritual bathing areas. This is actually one here, very well preserved. So they carried on their Hebrew rituals. When you get up on top there, it is a spectacular view. We had a relatively nice day when we were at Masada. Thankfully, it had stormed heavy, very dangerous storms for 4 or 5 days while we were in Israel, in Jerusalem. And so we were glad to see the sunshine when we got there. And as you stand on top of Masada, you look out across to, if you could see on a clear day, you could actually see Mount Nebo across the Dead Sea and across the Jordan River. And you look out across this beautiful view, and sadly, none of my pictures are able to pick up the contrast in color that I can see on my monitor. You just can't see them on the screen. But that's the Dead Sea. And doesn't that look like Arizona? I mean, anybody from Arizona would feel at home there. Fascinating discovery, I've told you about this, was made when they were doing some excavations back in the 60s. You're looking at date palm seeds that they were able to determine came from the first century. So those date palm seeds were 2,000 years old. And you're looking at what has now become known as the Methuselah palm. They were able to plant one of those seeds in 2006. This is the last picture that I can find of it. I'm sure it's grown some more. And as a matter of fact, if it was a female, by 2010, it should have borne fruit. But I haven't been able to find any updated information on it. But isn't that amazing? I thought that there were some seeds that were older than the Methuselah palm that had been brought to germination. But as it turns out, that's the oldest plant that has ever been brought to fruition from an ancient seed. So, interesting stuff. Now I want to take you down the road just a little bit to a place that is, again, doesn't have a specific Bible reference that we know of, but it's probably a place where David was familiar. It's probably a place where Moses was familiar and Abraham. It's likely a place that all Old Testament biblical characters were aware of and visited at one time or another because it has always been there. In Jedi, and I'm not sure that's the pronunciation. In fact, I'm sure it's not the pronunciation. But here's where it is located. And we were just at Masada which is just down here. This is a very fascinating place because in all of the aridness, is that a word, that exists, you have an oasis that springs out of the rocks and out of the mountains. I took this from a distance. We'll get closer. But can you see that little stream, that little waterfall coming down there? You see the greenery here, and you see this little cave area. If I could, here, this is a person right there, and that's a person right there, and there's some, that's a person right there. That's how far away we are from it. But you're looking up a canyon to a spring. This may be one of the places where David fled when Saul was after him, because it's a place that in the middle of the desert is abundant with wildlife. Can you find the wildlife in this picture? There he is. He's hanging out right there. And there's a little closer picture of him. And he's called a hyrax. Now, I made a faux pas. I know you're shocked to learn that I would faux pas anything. But I said to our Israeli guide, Mike Rogoff, it looks like neutrina. South America, I'm sure in Guatemala they have neutrina. There are these huge rodents, which the people actually eat. But I was corrected. Mike Rogoff said, that's not neutrina. It's not a rodent. He's related to the elephant family. I said, yeah, you know, I think there was some cross-contamination in that lab because it sure doesn't look like an elephant. It looked like a neutrina, but they're wild and they're everywhere there. And then the second thing that you find there everywhere are ibex. Here's a distant view of the ibex that are there. They're the here's a peekaboo ibex looking around the corner. They're fascinating animals. They're mountain goats. From Psalms, we have the reference both to the hyrax and the ibex. Different names are used, but you could insert those two names in Psalm 104 that Cliff read to us, and you'd understand the animals that the psalmist made reference to. They protect these animals. This is in a game reserve, but I understand that, like wild game in the United States, they eat them. This is what the male looks like. Got a real interesting, fancy horn. And that's where, if you'll look at that horn a little bit, that's where the Jewish shofar comes from. They prize these horns for in their ceremonies. So that's where they got these things. This is what it looks like around the water at certain times of the year. And this water flows all year round. I thought perhaps it would be seasonal. There was a lot of water there when we were there. Of course, as I said, it stormed for days before we got there. But these springs are found there all year round with great quantities of flowing water. And there's three or four different pools, and they become quite a gathering spot. We did not that day have the time to climb up that canyon and get into the pools ourselves. And as a matter of fact, I think it was just a little bit chilly on the day that we were there. But as you look back from this reserve area across to the Dead Sea, you can see how a spring like this suddenly makes an oasis wherever it is. Here you have palm trees and date palms and avocados and mangoes. In some places around the Dead Sea, as around the Sea of Galilee, they were growing bananas. It's just amazing what it is that they can grow there and in great, great abundance. And you remember that picture I showed you of the ibex? There they are. So you can see how high up in the air that we are here. These are mangoes. I believe those are date palms down there. It is out of these vast desert areas, suddenly you've got this area and the view toward the Dead Sea is beautiful. The Dead Sea is mentioned many, many times in the Old Testament and in the New. As I mentioned, it's 65 miles south of the Sea of Galilee. It's about 9.5 miles wide and about 48 miles long. And they're very, very worried about it these days. There's only a fraction of the water presently flowing into it that once flowed into it because of what Israel needs in the way of fresh water from the Jordan and what the Jordanians need. They take 75 and sometimes 80% of the water. So today, as we visited there, and particularly in this area, there were some hotels that back in the 50s and 60s were built right on the shoreline that are now 300 and 400 and 500 feet away from the lake and have been abandoned. And there's all kinds of ecological problems associated with the low state of the Sea of the Dead Sea. They're thinking about ways to solve the problem because they know they can't give up that fresh water supply. And they know the Jordanians aren't going to quit taking fresh water from the Jordan. So Israel and Jordan are cooperating in an effort to bring salt water from the Red Sea in a pipeline all the way down to the Dead Sea to replenish it and to bring the water levels back up again. The Dead Sea is the lowest body of water on the face of the earth. Since it is the lowest spot on earth, you understand why. It is also the saltiest body of water in on the face of the earth. It's 30 times more salty than the ocean is. It's probably most famous for the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, but it's also famous for being a place where strategic battles have occurred through the centuries. And as we passed by there, I snapped this picture of some Syrian and Jordanian barracks back in the Six-Day War. They occupied this territory and built these army barracks, and they've since been abandoned, and you see them all over. But it's a beautiful place. And the day that we were there, I know Les and I were both disappointed, but because we had gone there prepared to go to the beach and to get in the water. But it was, as I mentioned, they had had tropical storms had gone through Jerusalem. And I couldn't help but thinking of Garth Brooks right here. You know what I'm talking about? He doesn't have a clue. I've got friends in low places. That's 1,400 feet below sea level. This is what it looked like the day that we were there. See all this debris? These workers are scooping up 20, 30 feet of debris that had been washed out into the Dead Sea and that was now coming up on shore. And I can tell you the people that ran this little resort area where we were, you could see all of the umbrellas, they were just sick about this because when tourists come through, naturally they have lunch, they lounge around, they get into the water. But you could see the dock had been broken up in the storm and all of this stuff, they would not let us near there. I was determined to get some water from the Dead Sea, and I actually got one of the workers to walk out, and he got out here on this broken down spot and filled up my bottle, and Richard and I both got us a bottle full of Dead Sea water. But Les and I had gone there prepared to get into this, and course, there was no way for us to do that. And we were disappointed. We wanted to have this experience right here. You can float in the Dead Sea without any effort at all because of the amount of salt that are there. You could just lay back and read a magazine. And maybe next time, Les, when we go back, maybe we'll get the day to do it. The salt there is mined in that section that I showed. Well, in fact, I want to take you back. Let me take you back to that map. I want to show you. This has been engineered. The Dead Sea originally took up this entire position, but engineers blocked it off a number of years ago here so that they could concentrate the Dead Sea water in this area in order to mine it for salt. Now let me get back through these. And the salt and the water, in fact, the water that I brought home in the bottle, they said, now make sure you don't drink that. And I said, duh. And they said, no, seriously, it's toxic. It's full of all kinds of problems, chemicals, because Jordanians aren't particularly careful about what they dump into the Jordan. So you don't know what's in there. And then the rate of evaporation concentrates all of that stuff. And so what they've done is they've built that area then to harvest the salt. And if you were actually able to get down and take a look at the rocks that exist there, that the salts form these crystals on the rocks through the process of evaporation. And then it's refined. It's very highly refined as they bring it out of the Dead Sea. And parts of it are used for medicinal purposes, and parts, some are actually refined until it can be used for table salt. You can find the facial scrubs, and we brought some of that home, of course, and all kinds of skin care products, which it's hard for me to put this all together. They say, don't drink the water, don't get it in your eyes. You got to wash carefully after you get out of the water. It's very dangerous. But here, we'll sell you some stuff where you can rub it all over your face. There's a disconnect there that I somehow couldn't get. And I don't know what happened. I know I bought one of these to bring home. It actually contains the mud that comes from the Dead Sea that's supposed to be a cure-all mud mask. And I must have lost it in transit. But there you have it. There's a look at Masada and the springs where maybe David was and the Dead Sea. All right, Les, you can turn our lights back on. You know, our psalmist said, God is the one who provides all of that. He's the one who makes it. He's the one who blesses the mountains with the rain. He's the one that causes the grass to grow. He's the one who feeds the animals, and he's the one who cares for us. And if your relationship to him tonight isn't what you know that it should be, you have this opportunity to respond to him while we stand and sing.